Chapter 54. The thermal image showed the sky above the plant to be lurid with heat. It was coming off the dormant furnaces and crucibles in waves as big as solar flares. The metal wall was warm. It showed up as a continuous horizontal band of green. It was much brighter at the southern end, much hotter around the secret compound. It glowed like crazy on the laptop screen.
"Some junkyard," Reacher said.
"They've been working hard in there," Vaughn said. "Unfortunately."
The acres of parking seemed to be all empty. The personnel gate seemed to be closed. Reacher didn't look at it directly. He was getting better information below the visible spectrum, down in the infrared. Vaughn said,
"No sentries?"
Reacher said, "They trust the wall." As they should. It's a great wall. They drove on, slow and dark and silent, past the lot, past the north end of the plant onto the truck route. 50 yards later, they stopped. The Tahoe's beaten tracks showed up on the screen, almost imperceptibly lighter than the surrounding scrub. Compacted dirt, no microscopic air holes, therefore no ventilation, therefore slightly slower to cool at the end of the day. Reacher pointed, and Vaughn turned the wheel and bumped down off the blacktop. She stared at the screen and got lined up with the ruts. The car bucked and bounced across the uneven ground. She followed the giant figure eight. The camera's dumb eye showed nothing ahead except gray-green desert. Then it picked up the field stone wall, the residential compound. The stones had trapped some daytime heat. The wall showed up as a low, speckled band, like a snake, 50 yards to the right, low and fluid and infinitely long. Vaughn circled the compound in the Tahoe's tracks, almost all the way around, to a point Reacher judged to be directly behind the airplane barn. They parked and shut down, and Reacher switched the interior light to the off position, and they opened their doors and climbed out. It was pitch dark. The air felt fresh and cold. The clock in his head showed 1:30 in the morning. Perfect. They walked 50 yards to the field stone wall. They climbed it easily and dropped down on the other side. The back of the airplane barn was directly ahead of them, huge, looming, darker than the sky. They headed straight for it, past cypress trees and over stony ground. The barn was standing dark and empty. The plane was out. Reacher listened hard, heard nothing. He signaled, and Vaughn came up alongside him.
"Step one," he whispered. "We just verified that when they work by day, the plane flies by night."
Vaughn asked, "What's step two?"
"We verify whether they're bringing stuff in or taking stuff out. Or both."
"By watching?"
"You bet."
"How long have we got?"
"About half an hour."
They stepped into the barn. It was vast and pitch dark. It smelled of oil and gasoline and wood treated with creosote. The floor was beaten dirt. Most of the space was completely empty, ready to receive the returning plane. They felt their way around the walls. Vaughn risked a peek with the flashlight. She clamped its head in her palm and reduced its light to a dull red glow. There were shelves on the walls, loaded with gas cans and quarts of oil, and small components boxed up in cardboard. Oil filters, maybe, and air filters. Service items. In the center of the back wall was a horizontal drum wrapped with thin steel cable. The drum was set in a complex floor-mounted bracket and had an electric motor bolted to its axle, a winch. To its right, the walls were lined with more shelves. There were spare tires, more components. The whole place felt halfway between tidy and chaotic. It was a workspace, nothing more. There were no obvious hiding places. And there were arc lights, faintly visible, high above them in the rafters. If they were turned on, the space would be as bright as day. Vaughn turned off the flashlight.
No good,
she said. Reacher nodded in the dark, led the way back out of the barn to the taxiway, which was a broad strip of dirt beaten and graded the same as the runway. Either side of it were patches of cultivated garden 100 yards square, spiky silver bushes and tall, slender trees set in gravel. Xeriscaping, near enough to the barn for a reasonable view, far enough away that light spill would fall short. Reacher pointed and whispered,
"We'll take one each. Hunker down and don't move until I call you. The runway lights will come on behind you, but don't worry about them. They're set to shine flat, north and south."
She nodded, and he went left and she went right. She was invisible in the gloom after 3 paces. He crawled his way to the garden's center and lay down on his front, with bushes either side of him and a tree towering over him. Ahead at an angle, he had a good oblique view into the barn. He guessed Vaughn would have a complimentary view from the other direction. Together, they had the whole thing covered. He pressed himself into the ground and waited. He heard the plane at 2:05 in the morning. The single engine, distant, lonely, far away, feathering and blipping. He pictured the landing light as he had seen it before, hanging in the sky, hopping a little, heading down. The sound grew closer but quieter as Thurman found his glide path and backed off the power. The runway lights came on. They were brighter than Reacher had expected. He felt suddenly vulnerable. He could see his own shadow ahead of him, tangled up with the shadows of the leaves all around him. He craned his neck and looked for Vaughn. Couldn't see her. The engine noise grew louder. Then the hangar lights came on. They were very bright. They threw a hard edge of shadow from the barn's roof that came within 6 feet of him. He looked ahead and saw the giant from the metal plant standing in the barn, his hand on a light switch, a huge shadow thrown out beyond him, almost close enough for Reacher to touch. 900 yards away, to his right, the plane's engine blipped and sputtered, and he heard a rush of air and felt a tiny thump through the ground as the wheels touched down. The engine noise dropped to a rough idle as the plane coasted, and then it ramped back up to a roar as the plane taxied. Reacher heard it coming in behind him, unbearably loud. The ground shook and trembled. The plane came in between the two garden areas, and the noise thundered and the propeller wash blasted dust off the ground. It slowed and darted right on its unstable wheelbase, and the engine revved hard, and it turned a tight circle and came to rest in front of its barn, facing outward. It rocked and shuddered for a second, and then the engine shut down, and the exhaust popped twice, and the propeller jerked to a stop. Silence came back, like a blanket. The runway lights died. Reacher watched. The plane's right-hand door opened, and Thurman eased himself out onto the wing step. Big, bulky, stiff, awkward. He was still in his wool suit. He climbed down and stood for a second, and then walked away toward the house. He was carrying nothing. No bag, no valise, no briefcase, no kind of a package. Nothing. He stepped beyond the light spill and disappeared. The giant from the metal plant hauled the steel cable out of the barn and hooked it to an eye below the tail plane. He walked back to the winch and hit a button, and the electric motor whined and the plane was pulled slowly backward into the barn. It stopped in its parked position, and the giant unhooked the cable and rewound the winch all the way. Then he squeezed around the wingtip and killed the lights and walked away into the darkness, carrying nothing. He had opened no compartments or cubbies, he had checked no holes or nacelles, and he had retrieved nothing from the cabin. Reacher waited 20 long minutes for safety's sake. He had never blundered into trouble through impatience, and he never planned to. When he was sure all was quiet, he crawled out from the planted area and crossed the taxiway and called softly to Vaughn. He couldn't see her. She was well concealed. She came up from the darkness at his feet and hugged him briefly. They walked to the darkened barn and ducked under the Piper's wing and regrouped next to the fuselage. Vaughn said,
"So now we know. They're taking stuff out, not in."
Reacher said, "But what? And to where? What kind of range does this thing have?"
"With full tanks? Around 700 or 800 miles. The state cops had a plane like this once. It's a question of how fast you fly and how hard you climb."
"What would be normal?"
"A little over half power might get you 800 miles at 125 knots.
"He's gone 7 hours every night. Give him an hour on the ground. Call it 6 hours in the air, 3 there, 3 back. That's a radius of 375 miles. That's a circle, nearly 400,000 square miles in area."
"That's a lot of real estate."
"Can we tell anything from the vector he comes in on?" Vaughn shook her head.
"He has to line up with the runway and land into the wind."
"There's no big tank of gas here. Therefore, he refuels at the other end. Therefore, he goes where you can buy gas at 10 or 11 at night."
"Which is a lot of places. Municipal airfields, flying clubs."
Reacher nodded, pictured a map in his head, and thought, "Wyoming, South Dakota, Nebraska, Kansas, part of Oklahoma, part of Texas, New Mexico, the northeast corner of Arizona, Utah." Always assuming Thurman didn't just fly an hour each way and spend 5 at dinner somewhere close by in Colorado itself. He said, "We're going to have to ask him."
"Think he'll tell us?"
"Eventually." They ducked back under the wing and retraced their steps behind the barn to the wall. A minute later, they were back in the car, following the ghostly green image of the Tahoe's ruts counterclockwise, all the way around the metal plant to the place where Reacher had decided to break in.